Hello on this week's program. As the Penn Museum winds up its run of Secrets of the Silk Road, the exhibition that almost didn't happen, we speak with archaeologist Victor Mayer. Susan Lewis visits the Sketch Club and the Plastic Club on Philadelphia's Camac Street, the Avenue of the Artists. A conversation with Charles Croce, CEO of Philadelphia's City Museum, the newly revamped and renamed Philadelphia History Museum at the Atwater Kent. And Tom Keels explores a project at the Rosenbach Museum in Philadelphia commemorating the 150th anniversary of the start of the American Civil War. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
After an undisclosed snafu threatened to cancel its first real blockbuster, the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology opened Secrets of the Silk Road, an exhibition of more than 100 rare objects from China, including mummies and artifacts, some of which dated back as much as 4 millennia. Originated by the Bowers Museum in California, the travelling show's third and final stop at Penn has had a shorter run than originally planned, due to what is being described as a miscommunication between the Penn Museum and Chinese officials. The Penn Museum has some of the finest Chinese holdings anywhere in the world, and shortly after the misunderstanding between Penn and the Chinese had been cleared up, I spoke with Victor Mayer, a professor of Chinese language and literature at the University of Pennsylvania, a consulting scholar at the museum, and the cultural consultant and catalogue editor for this exhibition.
So the controversy surrounding this exhibition, we hope, will not have taken away from the drama inherent in what's actually in the exhibition. Tell us about the genesis of this exhibition and what your reaction was when you thought that it might not be.
Well, the exhibition really goes back about 20 years when I began my investigations in 1991. And I took my first expedition in 1993 to study various aspects of the mummies. And there was talk of an exhibition back in the 90s, but we couldn't pull it off because we didn't have climate control. We just couldn't handle it. So to have the exhibition here now, I mean, the museum, those three galleries had to be remade, and it cost a lot of money. Actually, the exhibition was organized by the Bowers Museum in Santa Ana, California. And the president of that museum called me up in February of 2009, and said, I'm going to have an exhibition of the mummies from Xinjiang. I said, no, you're not, because it's not in the cards. It's not going to happen. He says, yes, I am. Do you want to be involved? And I said, sure. And then he said, do you want to have it at Penn for the third venue? And I couldn't believe it.
And when you looked at what he'd got on board in terms of antiquities, what was your reaction?
I thought it's incredible because usually, if China has an exhibition like this, they only have maybe 4 or 5 or 6 what they call class 1 pieces. And this exhibition has around 20, which are, you know, treasures from that part of the world. So it's really extraordinary that we would have so many of these top pieces in one show, and then a total of over 120 pieces. So I just couldn't believe that they would let this happen all at the same time. 2 mummies. One of the mummies has never been shown outside of China before, and neither of the mummies have been shown in North America at all. So they're, you know, just the fact that this is happening at all, plus how superlative it all is kind of mind-boggling.
The holdings that this museum has are among the finest Chinese holdings in the world, and I didn't even preface that by saying outside of China. What was the reaction of the Chinese officials when they saw what you had, or were they aware of it?
People in China have long been aware of our holdings. And for example, we have those 2-tong horses, which are like the Elgin marbles of China.
That's what I mean, they're national treasures.
Yeah, absolutely tops. And everybody knows that. And for example, when the president of China, Jiang Zemin, visited here about, I don't know, 8-10 years ago, I actually took him through and showed him those horses, and he was happy and satisfied that we're taking good care of them.
What are they doing here and why aren't they in my backyard?
Well, we know how we got them. We bought them from a Chinese art dealer, and they were legally obtained in those days. That's the way things were done. And nobody has ever asked, they don't ask for them back. It's not, and it certainly hasn't been related to this mummies exhibition at all. It has never been raised in the slightest.
Despite the bump in the road that in the lead up to the opening of the exhibition here, it does augur well for further relationships between this place and China now that you've actually managed to get your heads together and finally get an exhibition open. Yeah. What have the conversations been about the future?
Oh, we'd like to take our students over to get involved in field excavations. We'd like our staff to do that. And, of course, just general cooperation. So we'll probably will have more exhibitions from China. And we've already sent a lot of our best pieces over to China for long-term loan, Mesopotamian stuff. So this is part of an ongoing process. It's not going to stop with the end of this exhibition.
Would the horses ever be allowed to go to China?
Possibly, under the right conditions. But they, you know, we just finished conserving them, and the Chinese were involved in that conservation, which shows that they're certainly aware they're here, and they helped us to conserve them.
Victor Mayer, professor of Chinese language and literature at the University of Pennsylvania and consulting scholar at the Penn Museum. Secrets of the Silk Road with all original artifacts is at the Penn Museum until Tuesday.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Philadelphia's Broad Street corridor, with its concentration of cultural venues, among them the Academy of Music, the Merriam Philadelphia and Wilma Theatres, the Kimmel Center and the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, is hailed as the Avenue of the Arts. But the city also has an Avenue of the Artists. Known during its history as the Little Street of Clubs, tree-lined, cobblestoned Camac Street runs from Walnut to Lombard and is home to two of the oldest clubs for fine arts in the country. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis explores the Sketch Club and the Plastic Club as they carry on their legacies.
Hi, how are you?
Good, Susan. How are you?
Good, thanks. To see you.
Bill Patterson, president of the Sketch Club, welcomes us inside an early 19th century house where artists have been gathering for more than 100 years. The club started on 11th Street in 1860 when six students from the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts wanted to get together to work on their sketching skills.
But then after a while they had some social events and they started to realize that they gained artistically from those social exchanges at these events. And so it became more of a social club with a lot of camaraderie that gave artists a chance to network and see what other artists are doing and trade stories.
Art, of course, was the central focus, and workshops met the needs of a growing membership. In the 1870s, when the Pennsylvania Academy was temporarily closed down, a young artist named Thomas Akins taught life classes at the Sketch Club.
When the Academy opened their new building, his followers here petitioned the Academy to have an evening life class and to hire Akins as an instructor. So Akins had his beginning as an instructor here at the Sketch Club.
Other members over the years included painters Thomas Anschutz, Daniel Garber, and N.C. Wyeth. In the early 1900s, the club, with over 400 members, bought three adjoining houses on Camac Street and converted them to one clubhouse, with a library and kitchen, space to work in the light-filled studio which spans the combined second and third floors and also functions as a gallery, and places to unwind, like the basement Rathskeller, with carved chairs pulled up to long tables in front of a big fireplace.
One neat thing you'll see on the beams in here, there are drawings and artists' names and a peg. Here's the name, looks like Pitts, where Pitts would have hung his beer mug.
It was a great gathering place for artists, if they were men. Women artists were not admitted as members.
So they formed their own club.
Artist Betty McDonald is a past president of the originally all-female Plastic Club, which formed in 1897 and in 1910 moved into its clubhouse, also on Camac Street. The Plastic Club joined two houses to create its own upper studio with skylights, a basement tea room, and gallery and meeting space on the first floor. And the name? McDonald says it had nothing to do with what we think of as plastic today.
They used the term plastic art, which meant the malleable, solid art. They didn't want to be known as tea party ladies who appreciated art. They were actually in there with their elbows doing it.
And doing it professionally, as sculptors, painters, illustrators, and muralists. The club boasts among its founding members the three so-called Red Rose Girls who met in Howard Pyle's illustration class. Illustrators Jessie Wilcox Smith and Elizabeth Shippen Green, who worked for Ladies' Home Journal and Harper's Magazine, as well as muralist Violet Oakley, who created murals for Pennsylvania's state Capitol building, Senate, and Supreme Court. the two clubs were male and female counterparts of the same artistic community, one that Betty McDonald grew up in. Her mother, Dorothy Hutton, worked in oils, etchings, and lithographs, and was a member of the Plastic Club, where she'd sometimes bring her daughter.
I used to come and pose, which I hated, because you get itchy when you pose, and you have to sit and be quiet.
Her father, Hugh Hutton, was an illustrator for the Philadelphia Inquirer and a member of the Sketch Club. Betty grew up to become a member and then president of both clubs. Around 1990, both went co-ed.
We let men in, which was a big change. My husband pushed for that. He said it's illegal to exclude men or women.
Today, some people like McDonald belong to both. Each club, though, has its own history and identity. The Plastic Club is low-key, all volunteer, and focuses on its mission of providing a place for artists to come together to work and share ideas. Its current president is Bob Jackson.
Every month we have a salon here, and we just sit around and talk about art. We bounce ideas off of each other's heads.
Past president Michael Gwynn likens it to a gym for artists.
You can work out here and get better, and if you are already pretty good, you can stay good. It's a gym. It's for keeping your eye muscles in good shape.
And while Plastic Club members appreciate the over 100-year-old history,
we have no ambition to be important, to have any status. We gave our archives to the Historical Society. You know, they can take care of it. We don't want to spend our time preserving things. We want to be active and be friendly to the artists and let them come in and use the place.
In contrast, the Sketch Club actively preserves and promotes its history, keeping its archives close at hand. The library, ringed with portraits by Thomas Anschutz of members from the 1890s, has books and research materials collected over the years, and a large oil by Hugh Breckenridge of his wife and daughter, shown at the Academy in 1909, hangs prominently at the end of the room. In recent years, the Sketch Club has taken on an executive director, Barbara Murray, who says art shows help carry on the club's traditions.
The six bohemian artists that began the Sketch Club were very interested in bringing the public into this mysterious world of art.
Down the street, Plastic Club member Alan Claywins is also the exhibition director.
We have about 9 exhibitions a year here. There are artists from all over the country.
But ultimately, both clubs exist to serve local visual artists, like Bucks County painter and Sketch Club member Alan Fetterman.
It's more and more difficult each and every day to survive exclusively as a fine artist. Not commercial artist, not an illustrator, but a fine artist. It's a hard go. And you have like individuals here, so you can communicate and extend values and exchange ideas.
Today, Philadelphia is a city rich in the arts, with big museums and flashy performing halls and theaters. Yet in the shadow of these modern-day grand gestures that light up Broad Street and the Parkway are a few blocks that recall 19th-century Philadelphia, where artists, many neither rich nor famous, have always had a home.
WRTI Susan Lewis. Small Worlds, a juried show of 246 small works of art, is at the Plastic Club through March 27th. At the Sketch Club, another juried show, The Art of the Flowers, runs through next Sunday. And a solo exhibition by member Lucy Rome, called Petals and Shells, runs through the end of this month. Over the course of its nearly 75 years, the Atwater Kent Museum in Philadelphia has acquired the nickname the City's Attic. Its over 100,000 objects collectively tell the story of Philadelphia. Founded in 1938, it took its name from the wealthy industrialist Arthur Atwater Kent. Then Philadelphia Mayor David Wilson and Francis Wistar, president of the Philadelphia Society for the Preservation of Landmarks, wanted to found a city museum, and approached Kent to help fund the purchase of a Greek Revival structure on South 7th Street. The building, designed by John Haviland, was being vacated by the Franklin Institute, which was moving to its current site on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. But maintaining such a museum in a city filled with so many blocks of historical significance has not been easy. After years of financial struggles and a low public profile, the museum is embarking on a new course, with a just-completed $5.8 million renovation. Since February 2009, the museum building has been closed, but it's been hosting special programs. It's set for a major reopening in September. Then the museum will fully exhibit its newly acquired sharper focus and hope to live up to its newly acquired more descriptive name. The man charged with bringing all this to fruition is Charles Crosey, former head of communications at the Philadelphia Museum of Art and the Kimmel Center, and now the executive director of the Philadelphia History Museum at the Atwater Kent.
When you came to this job, it was very clear from the get-go that this wasn't about taking over an existing museum, that you were to lead this organization to a whole new phase. So why did you take the job?
Well, I thought it had a lot of challenges, of course, but I think the potential, the opportunities for kind of reinventing and putting the city's museum on everyone's radar was a great opportunity, and that's really what drew me to this museum.
On the face of it, it's going to be quite a challenge because for many people outside of Philadelphia, the city is regarded in itself as a museum. How do you get them away from, or is that the ambition, to get them away from Carpenter's Hall and away from the Liberty Bell?
Not to get them away so much, but what we would really hope to do was make this a prism, if you will, where people come and focus and get an overview of the history of Philadelphia, and then, like a prism, push people out so that they can really see Philadelphia and its history everywhere we look. So we would like to sort of be a focal point from which people could start their journey and then go out and see all of what Philadelphia has to offer.
Many people will know you from your time at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and you worked in tandem with Anne Darnancourt in what to many people was a reinvigoration of that organization. What are the lessons you bring from the Museum on the Hill to this museum downtown, do you think?
First of all, they're different in what they are. One is a fine art museum, and the History Museum has a different idea of collecting. I think the collections here, the 100,000 objects here, have not been seen in a way or displayed in a way that make people understand and are proud of their own history. I think this museum, you talk about lessons I've learned, is really for Philadelphians. My goal would be to have Philadelphians, those who live and work in Philadelphia and the greater region, to come here and learn about the 330-year history of this institution. If you look at the art museum, it's encyclopedic. It's much more international in scope and focused. So I think what I've learned there in a very large way, I hope I can refine and bring to bear here at this museum.
You're very enthusiastic on the idea of participation from the public, a lot of educational programs, and on the homepage of the museum's website, do you have something you'd like to contribute to the museum? You've actually said to the people of Philadelphia, maybe you've got something in the attic that is of value that might help us tell our story.
Absolutely. I think it's funny if you say the city's attic. I think that it has two different kinds of connotations. One could be it's dusty, it's old, it's not of use anymore, so we'll put it in the attic. The other is one of great finds. And sometimes when you go up to the attic and look through an old photograph book that you didn't know you had or from your parents, and especially a city like this that was so strong in manufacturing, whether it's pictures, whether it's books, whether it's objects that were manufactured here in Philadelphia, we'd love to know about it. Not everything will make it into the collection, but let's have a look and let's see if there's a connection, if there's a story that can be told from your object that you have in your own home.
On the second floor, two of the, we won't call them permanent collections because I don't think you want anything to be permanent, but there are two wonderful side exhibitions that you're proposing. One made in Philadelphia. Of course, a lot of people will be aware of Philadelphia's reputation during the 19th century as the workshop of the world. And the other played in Philadelphia, tapping into the great sporting heritage here. Tell us about those.
I think the play between made in Philadelphia, those things that were manufactured here over the years, whether it's Stetson hats or silver or furniture or toys. We have great collections, and that gallery will turn over every few months. The corollary on the other side of the room is played, as you say, in Philadelphia. And the great sporting heritage, if you go back to the Philadelphia A's at the turn of the century. So memorabilia in uniforms. We have Jimmy Rollins from his World Series championship. So this gallery will change based on the season, based on the sport. It could be college sports. We have a great history of college athletics here. So what I like about that, what I think will be very popular, is that you will be able to see the different sporting events. And when we say played, it could also mean music. It could mean broadcast, what was played here in Philadelphia. So I think there are a lot of opportunities. and it gives you an opportunity to look in your attic, whether it's sheet music or whether it's any signed copies of people who indeed performed here in Philadelphia. It's something we'd be interested in.
Final question. Philadelphians, I won't say world-renowned, but Philadelphians are well-known for being down on their city and not having the degree of pride that people have in other cities around the country and around the world. How much can a museum like this contribute to there being more of a joy about Philadelphians?
I think it can do a great deal, and I'm not a Philadelphian, but having lived here now for 10 years, there almost isn't a day or a week that goes by that I don't discover something new about this city. It's extremely walkable. History is everywhere. And my sense is if we could make this fun, if we can make this interactive, if we can make this an appealing place to bring a family and learn about one aspect of the city's history, then Philadelphians will feel, and I do think they have great pride in the city. There's so much going on here, and particularly when we look at the historic district. So my sense is there will be a great sense of pride. Plus, there will be local stories, people telling their stories. We have a community gallery that we're sitting in right now, in fact, that will be open to organized groups to show their history here every few months. And I think that will give Philadelphians a pride in that various organizations that are all over the city that have not necessarily had an opportunity to display and to talk about what their civic group has done in the city.
Charles Croce, Executive Director of the Philadelphia History Museum at the Atwater Kent. Its programs prior to reopening in September include a display of artifacts next Saturday celebrating local women's accomplishments, and on Wednesday, March 23rd, a panel discussion about political cartoons featuring cartoonists Tony Outh and Sinia Wilkinson, moderated by former city controller Jonathan Seidel. The year 2011 marks the 150th anniversary of the outbreak of the Civil War, the bloody five-year conflict that forged the modern United States. Now WRTI's Tom Keels explores a new exhibition at the Rosenbach Museum and Library in Philadelphia that provides a deeply personal look at the events that tore America in two.
November 30, 1860, was less than 3 weeks after Abraham Lincoln was elected president. John Henry Brown, a Philadelphia artist, had painted a portrait of Lincoln earlier that year and found that he liked the candidate personally. But, as he wrote in his journal that day, he saw Lincoln's victory as heralding America's doom.
A number of the southern states have already called conventions for the purpose of taking into consideration their separation from the North. It is now almost certain that this glorious union will be torn asunder and some of the brightest stars obliterated from the folds of the American flag.
John Henry Brown's diary is one of a number of artifacts currently on display at the Rosenbach's The Civil War Begins exhibition, which marks the sesquicentennial of the conflict. Catherine Haas is the show's curator.
The exhibit is called The Civil War Begins, and it's an exhibit about the causes and the lead up to the war and then the initial conflicts, Fort Sumter through the First Battle of Bull Run, First Battle of Manassas in the summer of 1861. And in fact, we start looking at issues of slavery and also some of the states' rights issues that were brewing throughout the 19th century. We look at the rise of the Republican Party in the 1850s, and then we get full force into Lincoln's election and the aftermath of that.
The exhibition includes notes from Abraham Lincoln, written in 1857, in which he tries to establish a platform for the Republican Party, then only 3 years old. There are letters from the radical abolitionist John Brown, whose abortive raid on Harper's Ferry in 1859 has been called the First Battle of the Civil War. Also on display are documents describing the life and death of Colonel Elmer E. Ellsworth, the first Union officer killed in the war.
He was killed in May of 1861. He had gone into Arlington, and there had been a large, really large Confederate flag flying from the top of a tavern, and he went in, went to the roof, ripped it down, and then was coming down the stairs when the owner of the tavern came up and shot him.
Ellsworth became the first Union martyr of a war that both sides were sure would last only a few months. His body lay in state in the White House and New York City Hall before his burial in upstate New York.
It's not only an important event in and of itself, because it was one of these big galvanizing events in the early war, but also I think it's a reminder of the optimism and sort of naivete of this early war period, in which people had the time and energy to do all of this. I mean, when you fast forward to 1863, 1865, you're counting the deaths in the tens of thousands and the hundreds of thousands. And people thought that there weren't going to be that many casualties, and that this was a really singular event.
In conjunction with this exhibition, the Rosenbach has created a companion website called Today in the Civil War, which tracks the progress of the conflict through letters, diaries, and newspapers, posted 150 years to the day from when they were first written. The Rosenbach has also commissioned jazz musician and composer Dave Burrell to create an original musical work, Portraits of Civil War Heroes. Burrell, the Rosenbach's musician in residence, has drawn on its archives to paint musical portraits of four men: Colonel Ellsworth, abolitionist John Brown, Confederate General Robert E. Lee, and Union General Ulysses S. Grant. Burrell's music delves beyond the stereotypical images of these heroes. For instance, Robert E. Lee's portrait is not a military march, but a delicate, melancholy waltz. Portraits of Civil War Heroes is the fourth composition Dave Burrell has created for the Rosenbach. Having previously composed works based on modernist poet Marianne Moore, the Lewis and Clark Expedition, and the Bill of Sale for a Slave, Burrell, who performs the piece with violinist Odessa Balan, explains how his research helped to shape the nocturne for Robert E. Lee.
We wanted to make a definite distinction between Robert E. Lee's battlefield image and emotions and his personal feelings when he wrote letters to family and superiors. The letters that I read at the museum's reading room made it very evident to me that this was a man that was torn by war and very much a human being with feelings.
By contrast, Ulysses S. Grant's portrait is a march, but it's not a swaggering victory progress. It's the plodding march of soldiers returning to camp after a lengthy battle, exhausted but happy to have survived. Burrell draws on a wide variety of musical styles from different eras and countries. For instance, his portrait of John Brown consists of two parts, life and death. The life composition, depicting Brown's children playing with freed slave children, utilizes African tribal rhythms and American nursery rhymes. The death passage draws on traditional mourning music, but also incorporates unusual rhythms and sounds.
The dirge piece, the sad piece, has the heartbeat, the human heartbeat, and the intensity of the heartbeat, and then the lack of heartbeat at all, and church bells, and those clusters, and polytonalities represent the people that came to view the hanging, that were pro-hanging, and those that were against.
America is still divided by many of the same issues that split the country 150 years ago: racial conflict, economic inequality, and personal freedom versus federal power. Visitors to the Rosenbach may gain some valuable insights into how the country addressed these issues in 1861 and how it can avoid the same mistakes in 2011.
WRTI's Tom Keels. The Civil War Begins is at the Rosenbach Museum and Library in Philadelphia through July 17th. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and C under music director Rossin Milnov. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.